We are studying the book of Samuel. I'm on page 173, 2 Samuel 19, 41. David's recovering from the problem he had with Absalom. He's trying to get his kingdom back. He's been ruling over pieces and parts of it since the defeat of Absalom, but has not yet been fully restored. Behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why had our brothers and the men of Judah stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan?" You know, people are funny in the sense that they have a tendency to rewrite history, even immediate history. So now they're saying, you know, you took the men of Judah took you over the Jordan, and they didn't wait for us to come and join, you know. Of course, the truth was is they were all behind Absalom, what he was doing. So, but rewriting history is no problem for most people. Then all the men of Judah answered and said, "Because the king is a close relative to us, why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us?" But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We had 10 parts in the king, therefore we also had more claim than David than you." People find anything to fight about. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring our king back? Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. So the leaders of the northern tribes came to David at Gilgal and say that the southern tribes had no more love for David than they did. They claimed they loved David more than the men of Judah. Of course, that was disputed. They said, "We're blood relatives, and we've not abused the king's provender." On and on and on and on. A civil war almost breaks out about who loves David the most. And this among the men who had all departed David for Absalom. It's pure. We look at the people at Washington, and we say, you know, how do you know if they're lying? And the answer is because their lips are moving. Because people can just stand up and say the most ridiculous things and act as if they're true. And of course, one of the reasons they can get away with it is because our electorate is so ignorant in the main and so untrained, uneducated, unenculturated, no sophistication, no discernment, and they just suck it up. You can tell what the condition of our country is by just watching the elections. You know, we have a 51-49 electorate right now. It's pretty amazing. Whoever said it is good to be king never had to lead people. Now, a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David. They followed Sheba the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah remained steadfast to the king, from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. Then David came to his house at Jerusalem. The king took the 10 women, the concubines, whom he had left to keep the house. He placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but he did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. Then the king said to Amasa, "Call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself." So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had appointed him. Joab had been the traditional general for the tribes of Judah, for David. And because Amasa, who was... he was Absalom's general, and he was David's cousin. And he had come to David in the last chapters, we talked about this, and offered to bring Israel back to David. And David made him the general over his army. He was upset with Joab, who had killed Absalom in spite of his orders not to. So David sends Amasa out to bring the people back. But he tells him, "Call out the men of Judah within 3 days and prepare yourself here." So Amasa went to call the men of Judah, But he delayed longer than the set time which he appointed him. The men of Judah won't follow him. David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do much more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sight." So the harsh words of the Judeans provoked this hothead Sheba to raising up a large northern army against David. And the northern tribes decide to follow Sheba, but Judah follows David. Now, these statements are sort of directionally true. In other words, not every man, woman, and child in the north was against David, but the warriors largely followed Sheba. Israel had been split before, had been split into two groups like this after Saul, north and south. So they had been through this before, and they were here again after Solomon. David goes back to Jerusalem to restore order in his house, and he exiles the 10 defiled concubines to his harem, and he provides them with protection and sustenance for all the remaining days of their lives. Then he sends Amasa, his new general, out to gather the army so they can go against Sheba and the northern Israelites, but Amasa is unable to get this done in the 3 days, so he sends Abishai, Joab's older brother, to take his personal army. This is Abishai's personal. Remember that Abishai controlled a third of David's army. Joab had a third, and Ittai the Gittite had a third. Joab was then the general over the whole thing. But so he says, take your army, your personal army, and go after Sheba before he can get organized, because he will wind up causing us more trouble than Absalom did. Well, first of all, they had no standing army. This is all gentlemen farmers. This is all gentlemen soldiers. There was a very small bodyguard that David had. He talked about the 3 and the 30. He had a bodyguard, and he had a sort of an extended group of men around him. But the standing army of David would have been less than 100 people. Yeah. Well, because whenever they went to war, everybody left their plow and went and got their sword. You had to be somebody like Egypt with a ton of money to have a standing army. And even a place like Egypt didn't keep one, because, you know, you have to support them. These armies in these days very often had no salaries at all. And remember earlier on we were talking about David and Goliath, that David was being sent by his father with supplies for his brothers who were in the army. So these people are supplying themselves and whatever. If you have a standing army, then you're responsible for all that. Now, Solomon built a pretty good standing army, but he had to tax everybody to do it. And that caused, part of it caused the breakup of the kingdom. Sometimes they could get to be upwards of 50,000, but remember, this is gentlemen soldiers, people coming out. Some of the other battles we've talked about have gotten as high as 30,000 people. Remember, back in the time of the Judges, when Gideon was going to go after Philistines, Amalekites, whoever it was attacking him, he started off with about 10,000 men. And God said to him, that's too many men, because if you win, you'll think you did it. So cut it down. And so he cut it down to 3,000. God said, it's still too big, and so he cut it down to 300. So he took 300 men against a much larger size. Abraham went after about 5,000 men with 318 hired help. His men who belonged to him, his servants and whatever. And in both cases, God worked great confusion above the enemy to give them the victory.
So it was sort of like our Revolutionary War.
Exactly. It was very much like our Revolutionary War. The Continental Congress put together a small standing army, but it was nothing compared to what they needed. And then, of course, when they all showed up, they needed training. What was the big issue? Training, supplies, clothing, weapons, food. Now, these are the big issues. And, you know, you may be a proud American, but if you've got 10,000 men camping out on your field eating every hog in the county, with or without a compensation, you may not be so thrilled about that. So it was a sticky wicket. Other comments on this? We have a philosophy in this country of keeping a standing army big enough to fight a war on two fronts. That's our operating philosophy for the last couple of decades or more. But there was a time, like at the beginning of World War II, where we had almost no standing army at all. And that's where the draft all came from. People had to be pulled in, trained, all that sort of thing. If you look at, if you watched a series called Band of Brothers, it follows a small, at any rate, it's a company, I guess, it's E Company. And you followed them from the time they were all drafted in and trained and all the way through to the Eagle's Nest. And with the true stories of what all happened. And, you know, their training, you know, we were in a war and we were having to train soldiers to go fight. We were not prepared for that. One of the things that just absolutely kills your economy is when you have to maintain large standing armies. And we probably shouldn't. But at any rate, Joab's men went out after him along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. And they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, the Cherethites, Pelethites, and the mighty men are the ones that we're talking about earlier. David's 330 personal bodyguard. One of the earlier things we read, it talked about the deeds of all of these men and who all attained to the 3 and who all attained to the 30, you know, and what their deeds were. Now, Joab was dressed in his military attire. Over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened at his waist, and as he went forward, it fell out. Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, but Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand, so he struck him in the belly with it. It poured out his inward parts on the ground, and he did not strike him again, and he died. And this, remember, is the second time he's done this.
Second time Joab
has done this.
Isn't this his brother?
No, Amasa is not his brother. Amasa is David's nephew or David's cousin who was the general of the northern tribes under Absalom. Okay. But remember that when Saul had an army, his general was Abner. And after Saul was dead, Abner was military governor for about 5 years. And then he set up Ishbosheth to be the king as a kind of a puppet king. And at one point they got into an argument over a woman. And Abner came to David and said, "I will bring the country to you." He and David agreed, and Joab heard about it and went out and murdered Abner. So this is the second time Joab has done that and threatened David's kingdom in the process of doing that. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. The other one, which is, I forget his name right now, it was something like Abishai. He was actually killed earlier on when they were pursuing Abner. That's why Joab killed Abner, because his brother was trying to catch Abner, and Abner told him, don't keep pursuing me, because, you know, I'll kill you. And the guy went after him anyway, and Abner had to kill him, and that put enmity there. So they're down to two. So, now there stood by him one of Joab's young men, and he said, "Whoever favors Joab, whoever's for David, let him follow Joab." But the Amasai lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. When the men saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came by him stood still. So, as people were coming by and they were watching this guy bleeding out, you know, writhing in the field and on the roadbed, they said, "Well, he's distracting it." So they took him over to the field, dumped him in the field, threw a blanket over him so that he wouldn't be a distraction. As soon as he was removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Remember what we talked about before. Joab has got the pictures on David. Joab knows what he did to Uriah the Hittite. And David's not in a position to deal with him like he wants to, because he is complicit with Joab in the murder of Uriah the Hittite. Joab has been a good general for David, been faithful to him the whole time. He's his nephew. From the time David was actually a young soldier, Joab has been by his side, but he and his brothers are bloodthirsty men, and they all they know is warfare. You know, so when there's not a war, they're going to look for one, because that's what they know how to do. They can't farm. Yes, that's right. Joab is killing a cousin here. Joab's actually a nephew of David's, and Amasa was a cousin of David's. I believe that's how that goes. But they're family. He's close family. The army that come with Amasa is confused and shocked until they are chastised by one of Joab's men. The support David now means to support Joab. So they lead him bleeding death on the side of the road while they speed off in pursuit of Sheba. Now he, Joab, went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel, even to Beth Maacah, and all the Barites, and they gathered together also one after him. They came and besieged him in Abel Beth Maacah, and they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. So Sheba is fleeing for his life. Joab is a much better general, and his troops are much better troops, because they are the standing army. And so he's in trouble, and he's hiding himself in Abel Beth Maacah. And so the people of Joab are in the process of tearing the city down. They want to tear the walls down. When a wise woman called from the city, and she said, "Hear, hear, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." So he approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" He said, "I am." And she said, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." He said, "I'm listening." She spoke and said, "Formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel. And thus they ended the dispute." Abel was a city known for its wisdom, its wise leaders. "I am of those who are peaceful and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel." In other words, it's one of the great cities of Israel. It's one of the cities from which springs the wisdom and guidance and whatever. So you're trying to destroy one of the mother cities in Israel. "Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" God has built something wonderful here. "Why would you tear it down?" And Joab answered and said, Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case, but a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, I will depart from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it over to Joab. See, even the old ladies are tough to deal with in this culture. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent, and Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. She thought, why should we destroy a good city over some lunatic who's, you know, built up an army against the king? Let's just deal with this. And so they drag him down from wherever he is, hack off his head, and she tosses it over the wall.
But that's better than getting all destroyed.
Well, yeah. This is part of the reason why they're known as the wise people. So, try not to impose your 21st century sensitivities against this, you know. And you know what this is like. We've talked about progressive revelation before. But most of us, or many of us, grew up around outhouses with no indoor plumbing. And now, we look at something like that as really primitive. But back then, you know, you had a real need for the Sears catalog, because that's what you use for toilet paper. Back now, they didn't have those nice, neat, fluffy rolls and all that kind of stuff. So we have progressed and all grown, whatever, our sensitivities have changed from what they were not 40 years ago. My grandma and grandpa Clark had a two-holer. So, you know, people would sit and chat. Well, I've seen three-holers down the country.
There were times when that was necessary.
There were times when that was necessary. And, you know, you can say, oh, my Lord, but that's that was, you know. Try to imagine a little flu going around, you know.
Oh. Nancy.
Pardon?
Ephesus, they had, it was a social thing.
Yeah.
You had to make an appointment for one of those positions, and you came over that time of day and did your business.
There you go. So, yeah, you know, the plumbing was what the plumbing was.
My dad put it down there.
When we were in Pompeii, pardon?
I said, I bet it was a lot harder to potty train.
And a lot less necessary. Well, it was a good way to keep the yard clean. And I mean, so but my point is that that was normal then. That was normal. You know, good and decent. The finest people in the land, you know, sitting there and chatted the news with whoever was next to them.
That was more than 40 years ago.
Pardon?
That was more than 40 years ago.
Well,
40 years ago.
You did, but not everybody in this country did. We're from Kentucky, Bubba. You know, I remember when I was 12 years old going to the outhouse of my grandmother's. That's 50 years ago. So it's not that long ago is the point. One of my favorite jokes is about the young couple who just got married, and they were in the outhouse, and the guy got up, and he drops a quarter out of his pants down into the outhouse. And so he looks at her and he opens up his wallet and he takes a $10 bill and he throws it down. She said, what'd you do that for? He said, you don't think I'm going down there for a quarter, do you? All right. Now, I know you think I'm being tacky, but listen, that was normal not that long ago among the finest of families. I don't think so. Now, interestingly enough, you realize that the Romans had full plumbing? The Romans had full plumbing. And so what's happened is, it's kind of like this, whatever, the Dark Ages, you know? I mean, and when you get into primitive places, no matter what the age is, they're primitive. If you go to Africa, and you'll see all kinds of things. So our 21st century sensitivities, we cannot judge with our 21st century sensitivities. And we have to realize that the light of God has grown, except during the ages when it ebbed. And right now what's happening is it's ebbing again. You know, if you think about this, in that same time frame, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, there were not gangs of kids running up and down the road, killing people, slitting people's throats, stealing things, knocking over old lady. I mean, that wasn't going on. And today we've got a huge culture in our country of lawlessness. That's all some kids know. They've grown up in these conditions where the only family and security they can find is in the gangs. And so, you know, we need to ask the Lord for help. Alrighty here. And we need to help them so that they don't have to do that. As mentioned, the elders of Abel were wise men, so the head of Sheba is soon launched over the wall. Joel calls off the war. Everyone goes home in peace, except, of course, Sheba. But he's past caring. Now, Joab was over the whole army of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and Pelethites. Adoram was over the forced labor. Jehoshaphat was the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. Sheba was a scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira the Jairite was also a priest to David. So this is his cabinet. This is kind of summarizing his cabinet here. His personal bodyguard is led by Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. Adoram was in charge of forced labor. He was the secretary of labor. Israel had collected people to do forced labor, and most of these people were foreigners, but many of them were people who had gone into debt and whatever, and they were basically forced laborers. Now, when Solomon comes along, he turns what is a small group of people into something near 20% of the nation. We'll get to that later. But there's already a Secretary of Labor way back at the time of David. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, he was the scribe for the kingdom. Sheba was the scribe. He was the recorder, the priest. So anyway, this is his cabinet. So he restructures his government with Joab as his commander, Benaiah as his bodyguard. The main chapters of 2 Samuel are 6. The remaining 6 chapters of 2 Samuel are 6 disconnected appendices. So there's no particular order or time frame in this. Yes?
Is there any place in Samuel where David actually sits down with Joab and says, hey, you know, I've elected a new general and you're out? All you see is Joab killing the guy that David puts in charge, and then it's like, you know, Joab's head of the army again.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that David's HR procedures were as good as ours. I'm serious. He and Joab have arguments about Joab's style. But when he gets mad, he just says to someone, "You're the new general." Yeah.
David and Joab while all of this.
Well, Joab was David's nephew. And David was in his 40s. David reigned, let's see, he reigned for 7 years over Israel only, and then 33 years over all the countries. And so he probably reigned at about age 30, I'm guessing. And so David would have been in his early 40s at this point, which means Joab would have probably been in his late 30s.
You know?
Joab would have known David from his youth. I mean, he was younger than David, probably. Now, yeah, I say that because that's typically how it is. But I have an uncle that's 3 days younger than me, and I have an aunt that's 3 years younger than me. Pardon?
Well, David was also the youngest of all the brothers.
That's true.
I mean, it could easily
have. That's true.
Yeah, so he could have been, yeah. So, I mean, they may have been the same age, but... My mother and my grandmother were having babies at the exact same time, June 3rd, June 2nd, June 5th. Three days apart.
Wow.
And my brother Mike and my aunt Nancy were born the same year. No. He wasn't going to give up his place. I mean, for one thing, if a guy like Joab loses power, he's soon dead. Because he's got a lot of enemies. So, no, this was a struggle for power. And, you know, there's a certain sense in which if David makes you the general and you can't protect yourself, then he needs a better general. But, no, it's kind of gang warfare. It's a different... The light of God has only come so far. Okay. Now, this next one's going to bless you, too. You're going to love this. This is one of the 6 sort of disconnected chapters at the end of 2 Samuel. There was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, and year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord, and the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." So when David says, why is there a famine? He says, because of the judgment against the house of Saul, because he martyred or butchered the Gibeonites for no good reason. That's why this has come upon you. So the king called the Gibeonites, and he spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you? How can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?" And the Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said, "Well, I will do for you whatever you say." So they said to the king, "The man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within the border of Israel, let 7 men of his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." Now, let's go backwards a little bit here. In Joshua 9, when the people are coming into the land, one of the things they're told is, don't make covenant with any of the people when you go into the land. Drive them out or kill them, one or the other. If they won't leave, kill them. Because I don't want you intermingling with all of these pagans, because they'll lead you astray, which they did. Because in the end of the day, the Jews, the Israelites, did not drive them out. In certain areas they did, but not in other areas. They wound up intermarrying with them, which they shouldn't. Various Amorite groups had tried to wage war against Joshua and his troops and Moses and his troops before for the crossed over. But God had always helped them. Then Balak, the Moabite king, tried to get Balaam to come and curse them, thinking that that would work. That didn't work. But Balaam taught the Moabites, after his curses wouldn't work, but because he wanted the money that was being offered, he taught them how to destroy Israel, which he said was, what you need to do is to find a way to intermarry with them, and then you can lead them astray over time, and then you'll be fine. It's kind of like you cut his hair, he's got no strength anymore. If you take away their relationship with Yahweh, they have no strength anymore. So he tried that. So he did that. But there was a people who lived in Gibeah. And Gibeah was in the heart of the land, and they liked where they lived. And so they resorted to deception. They took a bunch of their men, and they put them on old ragged nags. They dressed them in ratty, old, torn-up clothes. They stuffed their saddlebags full of stale, old bread and other food, covered themselves with dust, circled all the way around Israel, and came up behind them. And as they approached Israel, approached Joshua, they said, we would like to enter into covenant with you all. You know, we're from a long way from here. We'd like to enter into covenant with you all. Joshua didn't bother to check with the Lord. So he said, well, they're not in the land, so we can do that. So they made a covenant with these people, the Gibeonites, only to find out that they actually lived over the next hill. Now, when they did that, Joshua was angry because they'd been deceived, but he said, a covenant's a covenant. And so what happened, he said, you will live, but you will be our water bearers and our woodcutters and all this kind of stuff. You will work for us all the days of your life. And he said, fine, it's better than death. So the Gibeonites had a covenantal relationship with Israel, and over time, most of them became Jews. Well, when Saul, who was always doing something, you know, ready, fire, aim, he was trying to prove his zeal for God and zeal for Israel and whatever. And when he realized that he thought one of the ways he could do that was by stomping out the Gibeonites. Remember, Samuel had gotten on him, but not stomping out the Amalekites. And remember, he let Agag, the king of the Amalekites, live and all this kind of stuff. And so, you know, Saul never quite got any of it. And so he said, well, I'll just prove myself to the Lord. And so he tried to exterminate the Gibeonites. And they went and hid. The ones who survived, they went and hid. That was a violation of a covenantal relationship made in the name of God. And because of that, God put a famine on the land of Israel down the line for 3 years. It was time to deal with this issue. It was time for justice to be served. And when David couldn't figure out what the famine was about, he went to the Lord and asked him about it, and he said, it's because Saul tried to exterminate the Gibeonites. Now, we shouldn't escape our attention that genocide is not something Jews ought to be involved in, since everybody's been trying to kill all of them for as long as they live. So God said to him, Saul egregiously broke covenant with the Gibeonites and set out to exterminate an innocent people. And that won't hold. There's got to be payment for that. So David goes to the Gibeonites and he says, all right, we realize this is why we have a famine. So what do we need to do to get you to forgive us and bless us so that this famine can go away? Well, the Gibeonites are living in the middle of this famine. And they said to him, we don't need money, and we're not out to take revenge on the people of Israel at large. And so David said, well, what can I do? And he said, well, the man who tried to exterminate us, take 7 of his offspring, bring them to us, and we'll hang them. And then after they're dead, we'll call it even. Now, that sounds really gross. except it's a really, it's like seven of these people for 5,000 of the Gibeonites who almost went to nothing. And in our economy, it doesn't seem like what you'd get from that world court at Hague, but it passes for justice in this time frame. Remember that the Lex Talionis is the order of the day in most of the world at this time, which is the blood feud. And this is very limited and measured in that sense. It makes no sense to us from the standpoint of our Judeo-Christian light. But it was as God directed at this particular point in time.
But in the meantime, they were intermarried.
Well, yeah, it's more than that. But what happened with the Gibeonites in another place was there was this big brouhaha at one point over between the sons of Benjamin and the rest of Israel, and the people in Israel made a vow to wipe out the sons of Benjamin, and they swore that they would give none of their daughters to them. Well, after sanity took over and they realized they'd almost wiped out a tribe in Israel, then what happened is they said, well, we've done a horrible thing here. But they had sworn they wouldn't give their daughters to the sons of Benjamin, and so they obtained girls from the tribes where no one had sworn, but they were a couple hundred short. So what they did was they held a kind of a Sadie Hawkins day. The Gibeonites were having a Sadie Hawkins dance. The girls were out, and it was a spring event. And they told the Benjamites, the rest of Israel, lay low, and when the girls come out, go grab them and take them, and there's your wives. And when the Gibeonites complain, we'll tell them it's the way it is. And that's the story from the scripture. So,
I was just thinking how far-reaching the consequences are.
Oh my goodness. I mean, remember that the turn the other cheek hadn't even been promulgated yet. None of that light had come into the world at this point in time. We're living in neo-paleolithic times. I mean, we're, you know, in terms of what we understand. I've said this before. One of the appendices in this book is the section on progressive revelation, because without understanding progressive revelation, much of this time frame leaves your head spinning. For instance, it wasn't that long ago, in the 50s and 60s, which is not that long ago, 50, 60 years, that it was fashionable for women to smoke. You know, Virginia Slims and gown, whatever, and, you know, the real Marlboro man smoked, and, you know, anybody who was... C.S. Lewis, when he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, had as one of his sort of basic principles that the animals who smoked the pipe were trustworthy and the animals who did not were untrustworthy. I mean, he died the same day Kennedy did. So he's, you know, he finished his life in the 60s. So it wasn't that long ago when smoking was almost mandatory, especially from Kentucky where we're at, you know. But like, there you go, you know, it's as soon as you're born, you get them going. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised, because we have much of the world is still pre-Judeo-Christian. Now, when Moses came along and he countered Lex Talionis with an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a great liberalization, for which we in our society look back and say, what a brutal man, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Yeah.
But it was a huge liberalization. And by the way, about the same time he did that, so did Hammurabi, from a whole different point of view somewhere else. Now, it should be noted, too, that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in ancient Israel, almost without exception, was then changed to a monetary value, like in tort law. They weren't actually pulling out people's eyes or teeth. They would say, okay, now what's this worth? So, where am I here? So, the Gibeonites had... deceived Israel. They had this covenant, blah, blah, blah. David asked what Israel could do to expiate the sin. They told him, I think we've covered all this. David agreed to pay the price of expiation. The story suggests that we never really get away with evil because it always comes back upon us someday. Hence, Tamar and Sarah. And that particular thing there. Huge. Amorites is a huge group. It's kind of like saying Caucasian. Okay. Okay. So, Numbers 14:18. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. Now there is a balancing scale that has grace on one side and justice on the other. And in any particular age, we have a tendency to overbalance one way or the other. The people who are making you wear an A on your chest if you got caught in sexual sin, they were in the justice age. And grace was not really big in those days. That was in our early days among the Puritans. We have whole ages of history in which the church was involved in bloody, painful, torturous, brutal behaviors, all designed to cause pain to people in the name of God. And that's because it was so lost in justice that it couldn't find grace, couldn't find it at all. So, you know, in later years here in this country, grace has been so emphasized that justice doesn't hardly get addressed at all. People have a tendency to say, well, the God of the New Testament's gracious, the God of the Old Testament's judgmental. It's the same God. And God will by no means allow for iniquity to go unpunished, even when he shows grace toward people. So while he can make it possible for you to reestablish relationship with you or your neighbor, there are still consequences to the deed that you've done. You know, I know this is always, it puzzled the heck out of me for a long time. Kind of got my mind around it. 2 Samuel 21 says, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul. This is David going out looking for the seven sons or offspring of Saul. The king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the oath the Lord was between them, between David and Saul's son, Jonathan. David swore to Jonathan that when he became king, he would not kill any of his offspring. Mephibosheth was the one who was dropped and made crippled by the nurse, and we had Shimei and all that stuff before. So the king took two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, Armoni and Mephibosheth. Those are their names. It's another Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was a common name. Whom she had borne to Saul. And five sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul, whom she had borne to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Mehothite. Now, Merab was promised to David, his wife. She was Saul's oldest daughter. And it was promised to whoever killed Goliath that they would marry Merab. Merab was promised to David, but then given to another man. There was not a lot of love lost between Merab and David. At any rate, so he took five of her sons, and that made seven. He gave them in the hands of the Gibeonites. They hanged them in the mountain before the Lord, so that the seven of them fell together, and they were put to death in the first days of the harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest. So, instead of allowing them to be buried, they left them for the carrion birds to devour until the curse was obviously lifted by the coming of rain. So they hung them and they left them there until the rain would come, indicating the curse was lifted. Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until it rained on them from the sky. She allowed neither the birds of the sky to rest on them by day nor the beasts of the field by night. When it was told David what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, then David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the open square of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines struck down Saul and Gibeah. He brought the bones of Saul and bones of Jonathan there, and he gathered the bones of those who had been hanged, and they buried the bones of Solomon and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin and Zelah, in the grave of Kish, his father. Thus they did all the king commanded, and after that God was moved by the entreaty of the land. David was touched by the devotion of Rizpah for her dead. And so what he did was he went up and gathered the bones of Saul and Jonathan, took them back to the family place, dug a tomb for them there, and these seven bodies, and buried them all, which is sort of counts for honor. Everything having been made right by methods that are totally baffling to our 21st century thinking, God heard the prayers of Israel and removed the famine. So for a more focused discussion about why God allowed such behaviors in the Old Testament, read Appendix 1 on Progressive Revelation. I encourage you to read it. I panned it out a while back because we got into discussion, but I encourage you to take some time with it. Now, when the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David went down and his servants with him. As they fought against the Philistines, David became wary. Then Ishbi-Benob, who was among the descendants of the giant, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight, was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel." In other words, if you die, we lose everything. It came about after this that there was war again with the Philistines at Dob. Then Sibekai, the Hushathite, struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. That's two descendants of the giant so far. There was war with the Philistines again at Gob. And Elhanan, the son of Jeor-Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. This would be Goliath Jr. And there was war at Gath again, and there was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in number. He had also been born to the giant. And when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These four were born to the giant in Gath. They fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. So one of my former mentors, Charles Simpson, used to say, the reason why David put five stones in his pouch when he went out against Goliath is because he had four sons. He was joking, by the way. What?
You'll probably cover this when you do the next part on the beginning of time and the giants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Was Goliath and his sons part of those original giants, or were they
The Anakim, the giants are kind of a mysterious scenario there. There was a whole race of them, and at one time they were on the earth, and they were post-flood. They're post-flood. And some of the text indicates that what happened was that the angels, the fallen angels, inhabited women and had sex with men in order to experience what was going on there, and that the result was the birth of these giants. Now, I don't know how that works or anything more about it than that, except that that's what the scripture suggests in a couple of places. But there was a race of giants. Remember when Joshua came into the land, that he went to battle against Sion, who was the Amorite king right north of him. And when that wasn't working, north of him, which is now Bashan, there was a guy named Og. And Og was one of these giants. And he came out against Joshua and was defeated. When Joshua got to the interior of Israel and started to branch out, take over the land, there was a guy named Adonizek who gathered a whole coalition of Amorite, Canaanite peoples to come up against Joshua, and he was a giant. So these people once were a race of people, and then they would just pop up from time to time, genetic gene hopping or whatever that is. But, you know, even today we have people, you know, like that. There's a guy who drives for MedAssets. He's a driver. And he used to be the tallest man in the world. He's 8 feet tall. His name is Khan. And he's sort of bent over because he's had to duck doorways all his life. So he's only about 7.5 feet now. He was a driver for us. So they got him one of these big, what do you call it? Big
Mini Cooper.
Huh? No, those SUV, thank you. They got him a big SUV, a Lincoln Expedition or something, with a roof. And they took the back seat out on his side, and pushed his seat all the way back so that he could drive this thing. And he could stick his head out the roof if he wanted to, but he didn't. He just do this. John ran into this man in Miami who picked him up one time and had compassion on him because he was having a hard time feeding his family. And so he gave him a job. But there are people all over the world, you know, who are extraordinarily tall, 8 feet, 8.5 feet. There's a guy recently showed up in the paper who's a Chinese guy or something. And he was 8.5 or 9 feet tall, whatever. But, I don't know, giants were there. They were a race of people. Their genes got mixed all in at some point in time, and so you'd get these gene-skipping issues, and they would pop up again from time to time. When Joshua defeated Adonizek, the remainder of the giants in the land left and went to live with the Philistines. And that's where Goliath comes from later. Alrighty, let's see here. Now, it should be noted that Abishai, who is Joab's brother, and of the same ilk as Joab, was who saved David's life in this scenario. Ishbi-Benob had three brothers, Saph, Goliath Jr., and Anonymous. We have no name for him. Saph was slain by the Israeli warrior Sebekai, the Hushathite. Goliath Jr. was killed by Ohanan of Bethlehem. Anonymous was killed by Jonathan, David's nephew. And Anonymous had 12 fingers and 12 toes. So, all four of them were born to Goliath of Gath. All right. Any comments?
That's an incredible amount of detail.
It's never boring, is it?
Wouldn't it seem like some of the generals kind of did they change sides or allegiances over this period of time?
Oh, how do you mean?
Well, I probably don't know.
Joab and Abishai and his brother were David's nephews, and they were always with David. David set in a couple other people as general, but because he was mad at Joab, but Joab went out and killed both of them, and so they remained his generals. The third brother, whose name escapes me at the moment, it's like Abishai, but it's a little bit different. He was killed earlier on in a battle against Abner, and so a man named Ittai the Gittite took over as the third general in the army. He was a Philistine. There were a number of people like Ittai the Gittite, or for that matter, like Uriah the Hittite, who were not Jews, but attached themselves to David and Israel because of the way they admired David and whatever. Many of them became Jews, whatever. So yes, there were people who were foreigners who fought in David's army. Is that what you mean?
No, I guess I had a problem keeping up with all the different names and what their relationship to each other.
You mean David's generals?
Both sides.
Okay. Well, here are the main generals, okay? David has Joab, Abishai, and his brother. Somebody help me find that. No, Zerai is their father. Zerai is David's cousin. It's their son's Abishai. It's back earlier on. It's sort of like Abishai, but it's different. Anyway, and then Abishai, the brother gets killed, and Ittai becomes the third general for David. All right. Abner was Saul's general. And during the conflict between David and Saul, remember the time David snuck in and took a pot and a spear away? He chides Abner for not protecting the king. Abner was Saul's relative. After Saul fell, Abner ran the northern kingdom for 5 years as a general, the military government, and then set up a puppet king. And after he and the puppet king fell out, then Abner came to David and said, "I can deliver you the northern tribes." And David agreed to that, and so David made Abner his general, which Joab wouldn't accept, and so Joab killed Abner. Then later, when Absalom rose up against David, David's got the same three generals he always did, but Absalom's general is Amasa, who is David's cousin. And so, yes?
No. Okay, Amasa was killed by Joab.
So was Abner. Okay. Joab's done this several times. And we're going to hear about that later on. This ain't over. Okay? So, Amasa, who is David's cousin, because remember, David's son Absalom, who is David's enemy, is from Judah, because he's David's son. And Amasa is a family member, and he's sided with Absalom. Later on, he offers to bring the rest of the people back to David, and David makes him his general, and Joab goes out next and murders him. Okay, so those are the five main generals between those two groups of people.
Sheba was a general also.
Sheba was a hothead who raised up an army in the north. He was a rogue.
Okay.
He was a rogue. The tensions were high, and Sheba was somebody who said, you know, he's like Quantrill's raiders, you know.
The warlord.
Yeah. Well, he not really. He was probably a farmer, but. He said, you know, we got nothing with David, you know, whatever. So he raised up a sizable army from the northern people. And then Abishai went and chased him down to the city of Abel, Beth Maacah. Okay? But he was a kind of a pretender. He wasn't really anybody's general. He was self-appointed. 2 Samuel 22. David prays, poem of praise to God. This chapter is a repeat of Psalm 18, and it needs no commentary. Its meaning is pretty straightforward. David spoke the words of this song to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God and my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold, my refuge, my Savior. Thou dost save me from violence. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. For the waves of death encompassed me, and the torrents of destruction overwhelmed me. The cords of Sheol surrounded me, and the snares of death confronted me. In my distress I called upon the Lord. Yes, I cried to my God, and from his temple he heard my voice, and my cry for help came into his ears. And the earth shook and quaked, and the foundations of heaven were trembling and were shaken, because he, God, was angry. Smoke went up out of his nostrils, fire from his mouth devoured, coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also. He came down, thick darkness under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He appeared on the wings of the wind. He made darkness canopies around him, a mass of waters, thick clouds of the sky. From the brightness before him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice. He sent out arrows, scattering them, lightning, and routed them." It's a pretty good description of the Shekinah glory of God, by the way. "The channels of the sea appeared. The foundations of the world were laid bare." He's talking about the flood. "But the rebuke of the Lord, the breath of his nostrils, he sent from on high. He took me and he drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He also brought me forth in a broad place, and he rescued me because he delighted in me. The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness," my right relationship. He doesn't say sinlessness, because he's not sinless. He said, "The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness." Now, sometimes you probably read David saying things like this, and you wonder, how can he call himself righteous? He's an adulterer and whatever. It's because the word righteous means rightly related, does not mean sinless. We've said that about, 400 times? "According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me." Now, the cleanness of his hands might be on a particular issue. It doesn't mean his hands are clean all the time. If he's being falsely accused, his hands are clean. But to suggest that his hands are clean all the time would have been a lie. He knows better. "For I have kept the ways of the Lord. I have not acted wickedly against my God," at least lately. "For all his ordinances were before me, and for his statutes I did not depart from them. I was also blameless toward him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness, before his eyes. With the kind thou dost show thyself kind, with the blameless thou dost show thyself blameless, with the pure thou dost show thyself pure, with the perverted thou dost show thyself astute. And thou dost save an afflicted people, but thine eyes are on the haughty, whom thou dost abase. For thou art a lamp, O Lord, and the Lord illumines my darkness. For by thee I can run upon a troop, by my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, he is blameless. The word of the Lord is tested, He is a shield to all who take refuge in him. For who is God besides the Lord? And who is a rock besides our God? God is my strong fortress, and he sets the blameless in his way. He makes my feet like hinds' feet, and he sets me on high places. Have you all read Hannah Herndon's book, Hinds' Feet in High Places? He trains my hand for battle, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. Y'all getting all this? This is all Psalm 18.
It's all Psalm 18.
Yeah.
I thought that scripture was also in
Hinds' Feet in High Places? Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it shows up a number of places.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a phrase of praise.
Oh. Okay.
What happens is that, I don't know if y'all saw the Humana Challenge golf tournament this weekend, but there was Rockhorn rams running around the golf course, whatever.
Oh, wow.
If you've ever been around mountainous areas where the rockhorn or where the horned rams are, they have suction cup feet, and they can march right up the side, the face of a cliff. I mean, it is astounding. Yeah, it's just like that, and they just pick their way through it. Those are hinds' feet. A hind is anything in the family of the deer. And their feet are suction cups, like the way they work. And these rockhorn rams, they just... Y'all ever seen this, right? It's extraordinary.
I saw one.
Yeah. But you've seen them on the sides of the cliffs.
Yeah.
They're made. They're really amazing. All right. Thou hast given me the shield of thy salvation. Thou makest me great. Thou help makes me great. Thou didst enlarge my steps under me, and my feet have not slipped. I pursued my enemies and destroyed them. I did not turn back until they were consumed. In other words, you gave me total victory. I have devoured them and shattered them so they did not rise, and they fell under my feet. For thou hast girded me with the strength for battle. Thou hast subdued me under me, those who rose up against me. Thou hast also made my enemies turn their backs to me, for flee, and I have destroyed those who hated me. They looked, but there was none to save, even to the Lord, but he did not answer them. Then I pulverized them as the dust of the earth, and I crushed and stamped them as the mire of the streets. Thou hast also delivered me from the contentions of my people. Thou hast kept me as the head of the nations. A people whom I have not known serve me. Foreigners pretend obedience to me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. Foreigners loot heart and come trembling out of their fortresses. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God, the rock of my salvation. The God who executes vengeance for me and brings down people under me, who also brings me out from my enemies. Thou dost even lift me up above those who rise against me. Thou dost rescue me from the violent man. Therefore I will give thanks to thee, O Lord, among the nations, and I will sing praises to thy name. He is a tower of deliverance to his king, and shows loving kindness and mercy to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. So we're studying Psalms at 10:30 on Sunday morning, so some of you all get the feel for this. But this is a typical psalm of praise in which David is talking about his relationship with God and how God has always backed him up and always helped him and whatever. These, like all psalms, they are poetic. They're poetry. And they are directionally correct. I mean, there's obviously moments when David's hands aren't clean. There's obviously moments when David's getting his butt kicked. There's all this kind of stuff. But he's saying, in the main, God has been very good to me. And he has done this and he's done that. And he's caused my kingdom to be established and this and this and this. Pardon?
What was the literary style that you had talked about some time ago where it's like repeats? Like my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge.
Yeah.
I mean, stronghold and refuge are basically the same.
Oh, yeah, the repetition. Parallelism.
Parallelism.
The Asiatic poetry, for which Jewish poetry fits, Asiatic poetry shows its emphasis not by rhyme and meter. Western poetry uses rhyme and meter. There once was a lady from France, something about dance and ants in the pants and all that kind of stuff. Okay, a rhyme and meter. Da 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 da. Okay, those are recognizable patterns that have names, and even stuff that's sort of there are patterns of all kinds, and that's how Western poetry shows emphasis. Asiatic poetry shows emphasis by parallelism, repetition. So he'll say, the Lord is my rock, the Lord is the foundation of my existence, or the Lord is my shield, the Lord is my buckler. Well, a buckler is a shield.
Right.
And so they're just saying stuff twice. And then we talked about Sunday and then about the various kinds of parallelism. There's antithetic parallelism, where one statement sort of counters another. You know, in other words, the Lord is for the good, but he's against the bad. You know, and then there's parallelism that where one thing builds on another. So the Lord is God, the Lord is a very great God, you know, whatever. So there's all these poetic styles that flow out of this, and this is just inserted here in 2 Samuel, is this psalm that got inserted here in this place. Remember that David wrote about 73 of 150 psalms. The rest of them were written by various other people around, including Moses wrote one, Solomon wrote several, Asaph and his descendants wrote a bunch, Korah, the Kohathites and their descendants wrote a bunch. But of the 150 psalms, the 150 psalms represent 10% at best. I mean, maybe 2% of the psalms available for David to choose from. We are told that Solomon wrote 1,000 psalms, 1,000 proverbs, and 3,000 songs, which are psalms.
Wow.
But these things, you know. So what we have in the Book of Psalms or the Psalter is those that David pulled together, or were pulled together after his time to be the official liturgy of the temple. But there were a lot more than that. I know we got to go. Somebody's got a bunch of questions on all this.
That sure is a big passage to be repeated. That's the biggest passage I ever remember being totally in two places in the Bible.
Might be. But there are many others like it.
Yes.
And part of it is they come from different places. This was written in 2 Samuel, probably by Ezra, and the Psalms were written by David, so he just picks it out of it and drops it in. Yeah. So it's a, you know, if he did what he felt led to do.
Yeah.
If you look at the New Testament, there are is forever quoting Old Testament scriptures in bits and pieces.
Right.
Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, job description of the Messiah, is then repeated in Luke 4:18 when Jesus stands up in Nazareth to preach his first sermon. That's about six lines.
I found the other brother.
Okay. Yeah, Asahel. That's right. Asahel is the other brother. He was the one that was chasing after Abner and got himself killed. Alrighty, I guess we'll quit. Oh, you mean, well, if you notice, the Psalms are always in the King James. Yeah, like for instance, we've been studying Psalms on Sunday morning, 10:30 class, and they're always these and thous and thy day and all this kind of stuff. The Psalms were translated over in the King James. Any other comments? Somebody, anything else, anybody? Somebody pray us out, please.